This is Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll learn more about an animal that has traveled to make a home in Illinois. We're seeing armadillos, especially in the southern half of the state. We continue with our look at the Muslim population in central Illinois. Also, a plan to end a state health care program for non-citizen adults could save some money up front, but what are the other costs? We'll have a report. We also find out about celiac disease and hear from a mother and son sharing their story to help others. A board game invented by a Western Illinois woman continues to draw in tourists. And artificial intelligence, or AI, is expected to change a lot of things. We'll hear how some educators are putting it to use in the classroom. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, when you think of armadillos, the state of Texas may come to mind. But as Tanisha Spain reports, the mysterious mammals have found a permanent home here in Illinois.
On farmland near Carbondale, Agustin Jimenez walks past acres of soybeans in a wooded area.
Basically logs that have fallen, and then we look for signs of digging.
Jimenez is a zoology professor at Southern Illinois University. He's hoping to catch images of an elusive animal coming in and out of a burrow.
This camera trap here, and we're going to set up another camera trap on that side to document what is going in and out from both ends of this entrance.
Around 2 in the morning, a 9-banded armadillo shows up, heading out for an overnight meal.
These organisms basically have a compact body. Their nose is very elongated, so their snout is very pointy. And then they have ears that to some people kind of like resemble those of rabbits.
Weighing up to 17 pounds, with short legs, long claws, and a big tail, the armadillo is mostly a nocturnal animal. It spends the night digging for insects to eat. Armadillos are keeping wildlife controllers like David Easton busy. He caught this one-year-old in his yard the morning of our interview on the SIU campus.
It's number 16 that I've caught since the spring on my place alone because they're doing a lot of damage to my grass and my trees.
The creatures are not protected by the Illinois Wildlife Code and can be removed without a permit. Sadly, you're more likely to pass by armadillos as roadkill. That's partly because of poor vision and how they react to noises, like vehicles when they cross the road.
When they're spooked, they jump straight up. Well, if you straddle them in a car and they come straight up and damage themselves in your undercarriage, they're many times not salvageable anyway.
Beverly Schaffstall is the founder of Free Again Wildlife Rehab in Carterville. She cares for hundreds of injured wild animals. In recent years, she's seen an increase in armadillos, which are a challenge to rehome.
We tried to take them back to an area they came from. They are pretty nomadic. It's not like they've got territory that they defend.
The armadillos' roots are South and Central America. For centuries, they've expanded territory north, and they're the state mammal in Texas. According to the Department of Natural Resources, the animals were first spotted in southern Illinois in 1970. As of 2024, they're found in nearly half the state and as far north as Sangamon County. SIU professor Agustin Jimenez says that part of the reason is our rechanneling of the Mississippi River and its lower water levels, which makes it easier for armadillos to cross into Illinois. Armadillos have little hair and can't survive on ground that is frozen for more than a few days. But climate change means winter in much of Illinois is becoming more bearable.
The warmer winters that then suddenly become shorter and shorter. And then we believe that might have presented these animals with an opportunity to survive.
They're also the only mammals besides humans that carry leprosy, a disease that causes nerve damage. But scientists say it's extremely rare for the animals to pass it on to humans. And the armadillos in Illinois have not been exposed to leprosy.
So the animals that are making it here are those that were like free of infection. So since nobody is infected in probably 300 miles around, then the animals are like in a clean environment.
Still, scientists warn you not to touch the armadillos, which are challenging to document.
Tanisha Spain reporting. Her reporting made possible by the Backlund Charitable Trust. Group of state attorneys general is asking educators at all levels to have courage in the face of lost funding and lawsuit threats by the federal administration. Charlie Schlinker has more on that story.
The administration is attacking diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility policies on a variety of fronts. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul is among the collection of 15 top lawyers for states of the District of Columbia who have issued guidance on how to deal with administration demands. Above all, Raoul says, don't give in to fear of loss of funding, lawsuits, or boycotts.
But it's also important to know that if you capitulate to an unfounded criticism of your policies, this is an administration that won't stop at its first request. It will keep on coming at you because you've demonstrated vulnerability to unfounded threats.
Raoul urges schools and businesses to keep using the tools that make workplaces successful, the type of policies that prevent discrimination in the workplace or education institution in the first place, he says, are often elements of DEI policy.
So it's important to continue in the workplace, embracing the employee resource groups, to review statistics, to see how inclusive the environment actually is, to embrace pipeline programs for students and for employees. None of that is illegal.
The attorneys general, mainly from blue states, acknowledge the legal landscape has changed with the Supreme Court case Students for Fair Admissions, or SFFA, v. Harvard. That ruling prevents higher education from using race as a plus factor in admissions. Earlier this year, Craig Traynor, the Education Department Acting Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, sent a Dear Colleague letter to most K-12 schools and higher education institutions, which relies heavily on the SFFA case. Traynor warns against programs that may appear on the face of them to be neutral, but are, quote, in fact motivated by racial considerations. The letter says race-based decision-making, no matter the form, remains impermissible, and, quote, a school may not use students' personal essays, writing samples, participation in extracurriculars, or other cues as a means of determining or predicting a student's race and favoring or disfavoring such students. Relying on non-racial information as a proxy for race and making decisions based on that information violates the law. That is true whether the proxies are used to grant preferences on an individual basis or a systemic one, unquote. Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell says that's overreach because the ruling is actually very narrow.
SFFA has nothing to do with K-12 schools.
Campbell says the case also doesn't address hiring and employment issues. Even in the context of college admissions, Kwame Raoul of Illinois says the ruling still allows a lot.
It does not prohibit seeking ways out to expand the pool of applications that may come into higher education institution. It does not prohibit creating a welcoming environment within institutions for diverse groups based on their background.
Raoul notes Chief Supreme Court Justice John Roberts has also pointed out applicants can talk about how race has impacted their lives, and that can be taken into consideration. California Attorney General Rob Bonta says the allegations the letter makes are not only ill-defined in a legal sense, they are sometimes internally contradictory.
It is completely irrational and mind-boggling to suggest that the things that address discrimination are somehow discrimination.
The Ed Department letter says the administration will, quote, no longer tolerate the overt and covert racial discrimination that has become widespread in this nation's educational institutions. The law is clear. Treating students differently on the basis of race to achieve nebulous goals such as diversity, racial balancing, social justice, or equity is illegal under controlling Supreme Court precedent. Bonta says he's not even sure people in the administration know what DEI really is, other than a culture wars buzzword.
Our core constitutional provisions and laws in the United States, like the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the laws that tackle age discrimination and promote pay equity, those are all what folks would call DEI.
Bonta says when such programs produce more talent and remove barriers, it's good for people and the nation. He says diversity programs are tools to make institutions successful, and the Dear Colleague letter is bluster.
This is something that I've described as a soft power that they have. The legal authority that they point to doesn't justify their position, but through intimidation, fear, scare tactics, they are bullying folks into submission, even though the action that they are asking is not required based on the authority that they're citing.
The Attorneys General Group says it is entirely appropriate to take a pause and assess programs, current case law, and the climate to make sure they're consistent, though Illinois AG Kwame Ruhle says there is a fine line to walk in that assessment.
It's important to not just surrender to this notion of just being risk-averse in your balancing of what is worthy of fighting for.
There is yet another bulwark to federal threats. Here's Andrea Campbell of Massachusetts.
Rely on your state laws. They have not gone away. They are not lesser than an executive order in this context. If anything, they are lawful, and they require us to comply with them.
The group says it may be tempting for institutions to try to duck conflict in an indirect way. Kwame Raoul urges institutions to avoid scrubbing the words and trying to keep the sense of the policy.
But that's capitulating, just to say. There's nothing inherently wrong with the nomenclature of diversity, equity, inclusion, or accessibility. And we should not run from the language because we have an administration and extremists that seek to have us do so.
And Andrea Campbell of Massachusetts says if institutions do not continue to push diversity and equity, they will probably see an uptick in discrimination claims or environments that are not as inclusive as they need to be. Campbell says this moment is dark and divisive, but children are struggling. She says this is an opportunity for people and institutions to look in the mirror and ask themselves what they are going to do. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Last week, we shared some stories on the Central Illinois Muslim community. Amina Rahman examines the growth of the community.
Springfield is a close-knit city where everyone seems to know someone. This sense of interconnectedness is especially evident within the Muslim community, a vibrant and active part of Springfield's social fabric. Whether building strong internal bonds or fostering relationships across diverse groups, Muslims in Springfield play a vital role in uniting the city. Dr. Dilara Saeed, president of the Muslim Civic Coalition, highlights Springfield's unique role in nurturing leadership and connection across the heartland.
When I think of the Muslim community in Springfield, I think of the heartland of the USA. I cannot imagine the incredible growth and the incredible civic engagement of our communities. I know this. Many of the leaders from Springfield, Illinois, have mentored leaders across Illinois and in other places in the heartland.
The desire to foster ties not only across cultures, but also across madhabs or denominational differences in Islam, including Sunni or Shia, was what prompted the formal establishment of the Muslim community in Springfield just over 50 years ago. Former president of Greater Springfield Interfaith Association, Maria Mustafi, recalls how it all began.
Living there for 40 plus years, saw a huge change because when we initially moved there, in 79, we became acquainted with the Islamic community, which was very informal at the time, only 12 families, and it grew, to where there were 30 different racial and ethnic groups and places of origin. there were over 300 families. The other thing was our community was made up of people of all five madhhab. They all agree that it should be representative of all Muslims, regardless of what madhhab they were from. That became something different than what I've seen in other communities.
That spirit of unity and inclusion has extended beyond religious lines. Springfield has long enjoyed a vibrant and welcoming interfaith community, and Muslims have been an active part of it from the beginning. The community often invites educators and neighbors to join them for iftar dinners. For one local couple, Shaban and Arshad, this tradition has grown into a powerful expression of faith, friendship, and shared humanity that continues to shape their lives.
Whatever we cook a little bit more and just take it to the mosque. We made some friends who would travel every year, or some new converts just show up. We'll get personal stories from everybody. So it's just not the feast itself. It's true spirit of Ramadan, where you're trying to serve people and you get to know each other. I would say we would not trade that thing with anything.
Listening and adjusting to the evolving needs of a growing and diverse community is essential. A 2022 study of Illinois Muslims found that one-third of Muslims who regularly attend the mosque still feel their opinions don't count in the house of worship. In Springfield, the mosque leadership is working to address this, as shared by mosque president Yahya Zeno.
People who just came to the community are different than people who've been here for 40 years. The youth also have different needs. All of those people need to add to the mosaic that we have in our community. If we don't engage all of them and listen to them, I don't think we can move on to the next level. When people are given an agenda that is already prepared, sometimes this can turn them off. We have to include all of them in decision-making, and this is where the membership is important, because this will include their ability to vote and express where they want the community to go.
Sometimes unity starts with something as small as a cup of tea. In a diverse community, even chai can carry meaning. Community resident Shaista Sheikh points this out.
Chai had to have this amount of milk, this amount of tea, sugar. The Yemeni community bring their own chai because we never were able to satisfy their chai. And I have to say, once I started getting a little bit of the chai, I totally switched sides. But just these small things made you realize that, yes, this is just something that makes us who we are. But we still have to work towards the concept of being one voice, one community.
From cups of chai to community meetings, Springfield's Muslim community continues to grow, not just in numbers, but in spirit, rooted in service, guided by faith, and driven by a shared hope to belong together.
Reporter Amina Rahman. She and her daughter Hafsa have been part of the NPR Illinois Citizen Journalist team, and we will have more on their reporting coming up later this hour. More to come on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois lawmakers are considering a bill to create an advisory board to give schools guidance on how to use artificial intelligence, or AI. Peter Medlin reports on how some teachers in Rockford are already using AI in the classroom.
I am here to share my experiences and answer your questions about my work as a conductor on the Underground Railroad, my life, and the fight for freedom. What would you like to know?
That's a custom AI chatbot that answers student questions as if it's abolitionist Harriet Tubman. It's built using Magic School, one of the most popular AI platforms designed for schools. Last year, Rockford Public Schools paid over $200,000 for several years of Magic School's premium service. The district's educational technology coordinator, Susan Urim, says elementary schoolers are learning about the Underground Railroad with this chatbot.
It wasn't about fantasy. It was about being engaged in a conversation with somebody in a way that we couldn't have done without this technology.
So I asked the AI Harriet Tubman how they stayed safe while leading slaves to freedom.
When we needed to be quiet, I'd carry a bit of ginger root in my pocket to give to babies to keep them from crying.
One problem, there's no evidence to support that Tubman actually did that. It's an example of an AI hallucination. The chatbot also mentioned that she had a $40,000 bounty on her head, which is a common legend about Tubman that's also not accurate, but is a mistake a student might make. And as those examples show, this technology's not flawless. And that's before you consider AI's heavy environmental impact and the ethics of AI image generators scraping work from artists for training data. But AI is already in classrooms across Illinois, whether teachers like it or not. And it's one reason why State Representative Laura Favor-Diaz introduced a proposal establishing a state instructional technology advisory board. Favor-Diaz is a former teacher, and she says cell phones have been an issue in schools for years, and the state's just getting around to crafting policies, so it's crucial they don't wait that long with AI.
They're able to act nimbly and quickly to pull together experts, including classroom teachers in terms of practice. And then that first guidance will be issued July 1st, 2026.
At this point, she says the state really doesn't know how local schools use AI. In Rockford, Susan Urim says they started training teachers on AI a few years ago after students started using ChatGPT to write their essays. But they knew the tech wasn't going anywhere and teachers needed to understand it better.
How do you understand bias? How do you understand privacy and security? How do you understand the idea of hallucinations or quality of output? And then on top of that, be a good prompt engineer.
They went with Magic School because it's created specifically for the classroom. It has templates for teachers, and it allows them to monitor how their students are interacting with the AI. She says there are tons of ways Rockford teachers use Magic School, from those historical figure chatbots to building IEPs and lesson plans. Douglas MacArthur is an English teacher at Jefferson High School, and right now he says tools like Magic School are useful, but not quite revolutionary. He lets his kids use it for brainstorming topic ideas and cleaning up grammar, but not for original writing.
If you have the machine do the thinking for you, then you're not growing as a person, and therein lies the problem.
Brent Fritz is an engineering and math teacher at Roosevelt High School, and he used to spend weeks at home after school overhauling curriculum, days of copying and pasting into spreadsheets. He uses AI to increase his efficiency.
I did that again just recently, and it went from like 3 weeks, let's say, to about 6-7 hours.
Fritz says it also helps customize assignments. Got students who love Minecraft? Great, here are 4 Minecraft-themed word problems. He says that AI's integration in the classroom has really made him reflect on which parts of his job are essential and can only be done by a human, and what he's comfortable outsourcing to AI.
AI is not going to build relationships for you, but as an educator, like, that's the most powerful tool I have is the relationship I have with my students. If they don't trust you, they're not going to buy what you sell.
Fritz says AI could revolutionize education. Who knows what these tools will look like in 10 years, but honestly, he just hopes it cuts out busy work to give him more time to pay attention to what matters most, building relationships with his students. I'm Peter Medlin.
State enrollment data shows about 33,000 Illinoisans have relied on the state's Medicaid-style health care program for non-citizen adults. That includes those without documentation. They will soon need to find other health care options as the state is set to end the program at the end of next month. As Cindy Alcazar reports, health care advocates say the move could be a life or death proposition for some.
MR is a McLean County resident. He's using his initials to maintain anonymity for the story due to fear for his safety. MR said he had a lump on his arm that didn't bother him. As the darkened mass grew in diameter, it itched at most. Then it began to bleed.
I never felt anything, and because I never felt anything, I never had it checked. It wasn't until it looked like it exploded. It started bleeding, so that's when the clinic sent me to the hospital.
A physician from the community health care clinic in Normal sent him immediately to Carl Broman Medical Center. From there, he was referred to a hospital in St. Louis for surgery and cancer treatment. MR obtained insurance through a state-run program that offered Medicaid-like benefits to low-income, non-citizen adults ages 55 to 64. The program began in 2021. The state extended coverage to non-citizen adults ages 42 to 54 the following year. MR was uninsured at the time of his cancer diagnosis. The hospital assisted with his application for the Medicaid-like program. It paid for the surgery to remove the tumor and subsequent chemotherapy. The program covering participants ages 42 to 64 became known as Illinois Health Benefits for Immigrant Adults. It's set to expire on June 30th. Governor J.B. Pritzker did not include funding for it in his latest budget proposal. The state plans to continue health benefits for seniors 65 and older. In 2023, stomach pain brought MR back to Carl. This time, he received a stomach cancer diagnosis, but the health benefits he'd once qualified for were no longer available. he was unsure if his benefits were terminated during benefits redetermination, or if failure to respond on time with documentation caused the loss. He holds out hope he will someday requalify for benefits.
More than anything, I would really like to recover that card. I know it's difficult, but with some help, I think it's possible. That card really did help me a lot.
MR's subsequent surgery and the once-a-month infusions he receives at a hospital in Chicago are covered by the hospital's charity care. Advocacy groups say state-sponsored healthcare programs for immigrants reduce medical providers' uncompensated care. Research conducted by the University of Chicago estimated the programs are linked to a 15% reduction in hospitals' bad debt. Andy Almanord is director for Healthy Illinois, a campaign that advocates for healthcare for all Illinoisans, regardless of immigration status. Almanord says taxpayers pay more to cover uncompensated care than if patients had access to care through programs like HBIA.
This also means that people have to wait until their situation is so dire that they have to end up in the emergency room rather than being able to have direct access to a primary care provider or the specialist that they may need to be able to manage their treatment.
The fate of the healthcare for immigrant adults seems largely to come down to cost. State Representative Stephen Reich, a Republican from Woodstock, said the program was fraught with controversy from its inception.
All I know is that it was sold to us as a program that was going to cost no more than $2 million with an M. And when it finally got to the point of being brought before the House of Representatives, we found out that the cost had ballooned to $1.2 billion.
Many Republican lawmakers in Illinois raised concern about the cost of the programs. A number of them argued the state should not be providing health care for undocumented immigrants at all. Andy Almanord with Healthy Illinois says the need was higher than they anticipated.
With that being said, we don't think it makes sense for a program to be cut because of the need.
A report from the Illinois Auditor General indicated that the nearly 54,000 enrollees under age 65 more than doubled what the state anticipated. The state stopped taking new enrollees in June 2023. When the healthcare program wasn't included in the state's proposed budget, the Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services invoked an emergency rule to end the program. That move bothered some members of the Illinois General Assembly Joint Committee on Administrative Rules. JCAR monitors rulemaking and is the last backstop before their implementation. State Representative Reich is a member of JCAR. He says he had a big problem with the state using an emergency rulemaking statute in this case.
The way emergency was defined, should be defined, or is defined, earthquake, flood, tornado, disaster. If the agency is creating its own emergency, it's not an emergency.
The committee took no action on the rule, thus letting the program expire. Andy Almanord with Healthy Illinois says that will have fatal consequences for participants.
Really, people will die as a result of this program ending. I mean, there are individuals who have who are undergoing cancer treatment right now, or dialysis, or who have diabetes and who are relying on this program to be able to afford their medication. And I mean, people are going to have to choose between rent and going to the doctor's office or being able to afford their treatment.
For people like AG, a McLean County resident who is going only by her initials, Almanord's warning rings true.
When I applied for the benefits, my health was beginning to deteriorate. But as time passed, my medical condition has worsened. But at least I have the medication that helps me breathe. What am I going to do when I can no longer get my medicine and see the specialist?
The Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services website lists federally qualified health centers and charity clinics as options for preventative care for those losing benefits. In McLean County, Community Health Care Clinic in Normal and Chestnut Health Systems in Bloomington are those options. Community Health Care Clinic Executive Director Holly Wayland Hall says their clinic helped immigrant patients enroll when it became available. But as participants began losing coverage during the redetermination period, or for other reasons, they returned as patients to the clinic. Wayland Hall said the clinic assists patients searching for options, which may include seeking coverage through the Affordable Care Act.
When we deal with an individual who is either without coverage, losing coverage, whatever their circumstances may be, we very much take, you know, that social work approach of trying to help them through the process.
Wayland Hall says that includes helping patients who have language barriers. Chestnut Health System's Chief Clinical Officer, Matt Mollenhauer, says their clinics have capacity to serve the additional patients they may see.
That part of why we have such solid capacity in primary care right now is that we are a family medicine residency site for OSF St. Joe's. And so it's not only our Chestnut staff, but it's family medicine residents who are in our building. And we actually have first, second, and third year residents.
While the immigrant healthcare program is set to expire at the end of next month, some lawmakers are trying to fight to save it. It's not in the governor's budget, but that budget has not yet been approved. State Senator Graciela Guzman says she won't vote for a budget that drops coverage.
This is a deal breaker. We are talking about safety net systems across my district and across the state that have spoken about the devastating impacts that this program will have. It should be enough to give legislators pause.
The state budget does include $132 million for the healthcare program for immigrant seniors. I'm Cindy Alcazar.
Macomb is home to what is promoted as the world's largest board game. The game is based on Monopoly, and it was unveiled a year ago this month. It has proved surprising to at least one local business, as Rich Egger tells us more.
I'm on Macomb's Courthouse Square, which serves as the board, if you will, for Macombopoly. The game is played through an app, but real-life ties to Monopoly can be seen. There are stainless steel sculptures of dice, a top hat, and the game's creator. In a few places, art affixed to the sidewalk replicates the Monopoly board. Businesses line the perimeter of the square. One of them is Community News and Market. I headed in there to talk to owner Lynn Campbell.
We moved here because we're the community newspaper in town. And so we wanted to be up on the square, closer to where all the action is, closer to the courthouse, City Hall.
Campbell says there's plenty of space in their building, so they also started running a store. And in the past year, they become the place some Macombopoly players go to. Campbell says they probably figure a newspaper might have more information about the game. As the visitors look around, they realize this newspaper office also sells ceramics, paintings, and more by local artists. And they sell vintage and antique items. They sell all kinds of stuff. But what Macombopoly players want is some Macombopoly memorabilia.
You know, we're fortunate that we have some artists that can do that. And so, yeah, we created a bunch of magnets and postcards and keychains, and we have the t-shirts.
And they carry different versions of the board game.
People that are collectors are into Monopoly also like other themed Monopoly boards. So we got hooked up with a company that also does that. They work through Hasbro, and they just put out limited editions of different themes. And so we also carry a lot of those.
Campbell says those themed Monopoly boards are based on bands, TV shows, anime, and other pop culture. There's also a board that has Macomb references on it. As her business started becoming an unofficial Macombopoly store, Campbell asked players to sign a guest book. It has more than 200 signatures of people from across the U.S. and countries as far away as Australia, Denmark, and France. She was surprised to have so many people coming in to inquire about Macombopoly. She says it really took off.
Our July is usually one of our slower months, January and July, as far as the retail side of the business. And last year, July was one of our strongest months, and it was Macombopoly.
She says people traveling across the country have Macombopoly come up on their roadside attraction apps, so they'll divert from their planned route to stop in Macomb and play the game. And they come into her shop.
And we like that.
Macomb has a connection to Monopoly through Lizzie McGee, who was born in Macomb on May 9, 1866. McGee is credited with creating the Landlord's Game in 1903. The board game later became Monopoly. The Macomb Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, also known as Visit Unforgettable Forgottonia, says more than 1,600 people have actively participated in Macombopoly in its first year. When those players come in to Community News and Market, they often have questions. So Campbell says the staff has become experts on all things related to Monopoly and Macombopoly. And they've been surprised by what they've learned about Monopoly fans.
We have seen people share pictures with us that are Monopoly fans, and I've seen houses decorated in Monopoly, the inside of their homes. Every room is Monopoly. That's interesting.
Campbell says some of those folks buy magnets and other Macombopoly memorabilia to add to their Monopoly-themed homes. There's a new addition to the memorabilia to mark the second year of Macombopoly. The Macomb Area Chamber of Commerce changed its gift certificates to look like Monopoly money, featuring Lizzie McGee's portrait. Rich Egger reporting.
We'll return with more of Statewide in just a moment. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Amina and Hafsa Rahman have been reporting on the Central Illinois Muslim community, and in the final segment of their series, they share their reaction to current events. Here's Hafsa Rahman.
Springfield's Muslim community continues to navigate both local and global challenges, including international conflicts and issues around faith, individual identity, and resilience. A growing fear among Muslims is that their civil rights, whether as citizens or migrants, are increasingly under threat. Recent deportations by ICE have only heightened those fears. In response, local Muslims are joining the Muslim Civic Coalition. This effort is led by the Illinois Coalition for Human Rights. The aim of it is to lobby state lawmakers to uphold fundamental constitutional protections. Springfield resident Ashraf Demizuddin shares why he's joined this effort.
The thing is, Springfield is the capital of Illinois. We have a lot of opportunities to work not just for the Springfield community, Illinois, and for the whole country. That is one of the big motivating factors for me to move out there and say, now look, a wrong was done, but two wrongs do not make a right. So we have got to fix it.
The struggle for justice also extends beyond U.S. borders. While concern about the occupied Palestinian territories has long been present, the 2023 bombing of Gaza sparked a new wave of activism, especially in Springfield. Three Muslim women organized a local protest against U.S. funds supporting military action, and it quickly expanded. The movement became Springfield Families for Ceasefire, a broad coalition of approximately 450 people from diverse backgrounds. A protester was inspired looking at the increased support.
In 30 years of speaking up for Palestine, I've never seen this level of solidarity, especially from those who aren't Muslim. We start out with about 75 Muslims showing up for a protest, and now we have an organization made up of more than 400 people from all kinds of backgrounds, faiths, and points of view, but they all believe in freedom and justice for all.
And the support isn't limited to Springfield. In nearby Decatur, Millikan University hosted Palestinian-American civil rights activist Linda Sarsour in March. She spoke about intersectionality and activism.
I think oftentimes we underestimate the power of storytelling, the power of connecting with people, and being able to kind of share my journey in activism and organizing as a woman, as Palestinian, as a Muslim American, and also my work in solidarity with communities across the country. Times are going to be hard, but we're all we got, and we're going to continue to organize and protect our people.
For some Springfield Muslims, concerns aren't just hypothetical. They've experienced religious discrimination firsthand. The Illinois Muslim Study found that over half of Muslims in the state report facing discrimination outside their own communities. Muslim international students in particular feel vulnerable. Dr. Ali Nizamuddin, a political science professor at the University of Illinois Springfield, has seen that fear up close.
I even told recently my student, he's an international student, you don't have safety at this moment. Please don't do anything that would compromise your future until your situation is more stable. Me and my siblings have discussed many times where we need to relocate. The fact that we have to have these types of conversations as Muslims in this country is scary.
In the face of fear and frustration, Springfield's Muslim community is choosing action. Many are supporting advocacy and speaking up to ensure that civil liberties are not just promised, but protected. For NPR Illinois, this is Hafsa Rahman.
Hafsa Rahman, who along with her mother Amina are part of the NPR Illinois Citizen Journalist team. This four-story series, part of the Healing Illinois Project, Healing Through Narrative Change, Untold Stories, an initiative of the Illinois Department of Human Services and the Field Foundation of Illinois, it seeks to advance racial healing through storytelling and community collaborations. It's managed by Press Forward Springfield. Well, in recent years, more and more people have welcomed chickens to their backyards. But for those who aren't ready to fully commit, renting chickens is an option. Chicken rental businesses will provide everything you need, the coop, the food, and the hens. And as Skylar Rossi reports for Harvest Public Media, recent egg shortages at the grocery store are pushing more people to consider renting chickens.
Four chickens snack on a treat of dried mealworms, which Katie Hitt shakes into the run of their coop from a red plastic cup. These chickens have lived in Hitt's backyard in St. Louis for just over a week. She and her family have enjoyed the pale blue eggs the hens lay, and her three young kids are having fun with the birds.
That's the first thing they're thinking of when they wake up in the morning is like, how are the chickens and what are they doing?
This is Hitt's first time having chickens. She says she's wanted them for a while, but she was nervous about doing something wrong. She doesn't know anyone with a backyard flock, and there's an overwhelming amount of advice online.
I'm looking at all these things, and I just wasn't sure what the right move would be.
But then Hitt heard about chicken rentals. She could have her birds and coop delivered right to her home, expert advice, and only a one-year commitment renting. So the chickens moved in.
It was just like, boom, there we go. We didn't have chickens one day, and then we had a whole setup the next.
People are flocking towards backyard chickens this year. Rent the Chicken, a national backyard rental business, opened over a decade ago. Co-founder Jen Tompkins says rental interest is high.
We've been so busy, we haven't even been able to compare numbers now versus last year. But when we looked in February, we were already about 20% ahead on this year versus last year this time.
Hatcheries across the Midwest say they're also flooded with orders. Some point to the recent expensive egg prices and shortages as the reason why.
Things exploded, and it's almost 100% to do with eggs, the cost of eggs specifically.
That's Tom Watkins, the president of Murray McMurray Hatchery in Webster City, Iowa, which sells about 3 million chicks a year to people across the U.S. Typically, the hatchery sells out about 2 to 3 weeks in advance, but this year, Watkins says they're sold out through October.
So that's 40 weeks of chickens that are pre-sold. We have literally sold them, you know, counted them before they hatched. So
to be clear, even when eggs were at a record high average of $6.23 in March, you'd still be shelling out more to keep chickens than just buying the eggs. Katie Bell is an agriculture educator with the University of Illinois Extension. She says all the needed supplies, like the coop, the feed, and the fencing to protect the birds from predators, cost at least a few hundred dollars.
You could easily spend $500, you know, before you even get the birds.
And that goes for renting chickens, too. In St. Louis, Emily and Tom Schnitzer opened their chicken rental business for feathered hens at the beginning of this year. They offer 6 or 12 month rentals. Their packages start at $95 per month for a year-long commitment and go up from there. Emily says their most expensive package at $190 a month includes full care of the birds.
We'll come out, we'll feed the chickens, we'll change out the bedding in the coop, make sure everything is like going smoothly, just so it's pretty much the family only has to collect the eggs.
Katie Hitt is renting from the Schnitzers. Her family is caring for the chickens themselves. Hitt says her kids are picky eaters, but they want to eat the eggs from their chickens.
This is like, oh, I know my chicken. You know, they're already deciding whose chicken is who. My chicken laid this one. I'm going to eat that one. And so it's really cute.
Hitt's not sure yet if she'll keep the chickens after the year is up. But for now, she's enjoying the experience. I'm Skylar Rossi, Harvest Public Media.
A Bloomington mother and son, both diagnosed with a chronic disease, have shared their story to help others. Ben Howells, a student reporter with WGLT, he brings us this report.
Rachel Ackerman noticed her 4-year-old son Jackson felt constant pain in his stomach and was growing slower than his peers. So Ackerman took her son to multiple doctors to find out what was wrong. It wasn't until one doctor recommended a visit to the gastroenterologist that progress was made. They did a blood test for celiac disease, an autoimmune disease that damages the small intestine when a person eats gluten, a protein found commonly in barley, wheat, and rye. The test came back high, but a colonoscopy showed he did not have celiac disease. Still without an answer, Jackson lived the next 4 years without major symptoms until he started to constantly endure intense stomach pain and vomiting at the age of 10.
I remember like going to the hospital the first time and then waking up and they showed me the pictures of my stomach and nothing really seemed off to me. But then when we went the second time, and that one, I felt like people were more serious about it, and I just knew something was off.
Jackson tested positive for celiac disease after retaking the test. Celiac has no cure or treatment. It can only be prevented from a strict no-gluten diet. Jackson says his 10-year-old self didn't take that news well.
At first, I didn't really like it because I had to stop eating the foods I really liked. So I had to stop eating certain candy and stuff for Halloween. And that made me pretty mad because I couldn't have foods that I liked.
Jackson says he hated not being able to eat Kit Kats and pizza. But he says after 4 years, he has grown to live without them.
I'm definitely doing my best to keep it out of my diet. I don't struggle with like the temptation of eating it anymore.
Celiac disease is often hereditary. That was the case here, even though Jackson's mother, Rachel Ackerman, didn't know it at the time. Ackerman says she always faced brain fog and fatigue, but blamed it on being a working mom.
But after Jackson's diagnosis, and as I started learning more about it, I just last year was like, okay, I need to get tested. Let's just rule this out.
Taking a blood test and later a colonoscopy in late December, Ackerman also tested positive for celiac disease. She too has been gluten-free since January. Common symptoms are associated with gastrointestinal issues, but symptoms can include fatigue, joint pain, and headaches. Now Ackerman and her son live on a strict gluten-free diet. There are difficulties, but Ackerman says education about the disease can make their lives and others easier. They reached out to Governor J.B. Pritzker to create awareness. The governor signed a proclamation declaring May as Celiac Disease Awareness Month. Today is also International Celiac Disease Awareness Day. According to a study done by the Center for Celiac Research and Treatment at Massachusetts General Hospital, about 1% of the U.S. population has been diagnosed with celiac disease. Doctors suspect that's a big undercount because it is often undiagnosed. That is why physicians recommend visiting a doctor before self-diagnosing. Dr. Yulia Belopolsky is a gastroenterologist at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal. She says patients' lack of knowledge isn't the only concern. Some patients might feel they're informed enough to self-diagnose themselves. This can be harmful for several reasons. First, if a patient who has the disease restricts their gluten intake to prevent symptoms, they will have inaccurate results. But if a patient doesn't have celiac disease but limits their gluten intake, they are denying themselves of necessary proteins. Belopolsky hopes further awareness of celiac disease could help speed up the process and help people get diagnosed faster.
Creating appropriate awareness where if you think you have these symptoms, you should see someone so that you can get the appropriate testing and possible treatment. Or even if you think you have it and you get tested negative, it's an opportunity to see what else is going on.
Belopolsky also warns that ignoring celiac can be more dangerous than just a stomach pain. It can lead to liver disease and, in rare cases, cancer. And with just a speck of gluten enough to trigger a reaction, education is key to preventing people from getting ill. That's why whenever Rachel Ackerman and her son Jackson go to a restaurant, they have to be extra careful. Ackerman says she often warns staff they can't have gluten, and she explains the dangers of cross-contamination.
Use the same cutter to cut a regular pizza as a gluten-free pizza, or if the servers don't change their glove, crumbs from what they prepared gets mixed in with your food. Like, it's just a tiny bit of gluten affects someone with celiac.
Sometimes, even with their best efforts, her son Jackson has gotten sick a couple of times.
So while the crust might be gluten-free, you have to confirm that even like meat ingredients you think would be gluten-free, but oftentimes gluten is hidden as a binding agent.
Incidents like these are a common obstacle that those with celiac disease have to endure. State Senator Sally Turner, a lawmaker from Logan County, went to dinner with her staff one night. There was not a gluten-free menu for her staff member who has celiac. All they had was a spreadsheet of ingredients for her to navigate through. That's why Turner is pushing a bill that would make sure restaurants and food distributors are trained on celiac disease. If passed, restaurant staff would have to be trained on what to do when food or cooking tools are exposed to gluten. Turner says her bill could be a step in reassuring those with celiac disease can enjoy their meals without fear.
So it's really hard for people that have celiac disease to navigate through that system, and it's very helpful for food handlers to know these things.
Turner's bill has passed the Illinois Senate and awaits a vote on the Illinois House floor. Rachel Ackerman hopes to see it pass to give anyone with celiac disease some peace of mind.
It would ease a lot of anxiety. Mental health connection with having celiac, there's a lot of what's considered a comorbid condition. And so eating disorders are very common for patients with celiac disease because you associate, I eat food, I get sick.
Ackerman is also calling on the Illinois legislature to pass a bill that would make medical insurance companies cover visits to trained celiac nutritionists. Illinois lawmakers tried to push a similar bill in 2023, but were unsuccessful. While that bill is not currently in the General Assembly, Ackerman hopes their efforts will push future conversations. Ackerman also says the weekly chore of groceries can be a challenge for those with celiac. It can be difficult to find certain foods, and even if she finds things like gluten-free bread, it can be expensive.
Memorial Day is coming up, and so, you know, you want to have cookouts. So you're looking for, like, gluten-free hot dog buns or burgers, and to find them first is a feat. But then the cost of it, typically, like, prices have gone up, but it's anywhere from, like, $4.99 to $6.99 for a package of four hot dog buns.
Ben Howell reporting that story with help from reporter Cesar Toscano. That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Thanks for being with us. Join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.